Hello everyone, Sam McClary here, editor of EG, and welcome to the EG Property Podcast. This episode's interview has been recorded as part of our Future of Cambridge event and features Phil Almendinger from the University of Cambridge and a little bit of banging from the man working away in my kitchen downstairs. You will have watched a version of this interview as part of our live stream on 15th September. Do not worry if you missed that. There will be a link to the video in the show notes for this podcast. This podcast features even more chat, however. Too much for a viewing experience, but really good stuff which I wanted to make sure I could share with you. So Phil, who as well as having more titles than those we've seen on our boss's bookshelves on Zoom calls, is the expert when it comes to planning and has written numerous books on the subject, including a new one coming out next year where he asks us not to put quite so much blind faith in tech. In the following conversation, we talk about all things from planning to perception to tech not being the solution, and of course, just a little tiny bit of politics. But it is time for that usual disclaimer. This podcast was recorded via Teams, so while the audio quality, especially that banging, may not be as crystal clear as you've come to expect from an EG Property podcast production, I can promise you that the content quality will, as always, be top notch. So grab a cuppa, put your feet up, relax a little, and listen to this conversation with Phil. Joining me today is Phil Almendinger, who has a host of titles from the University of Cambridge. So you are Professor of Land Economy, Head of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences, a member of the Royal Town Planning Institute, a member of the RICS, of course, and a fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences. That is a lot to get on a business card, but a great pedigree too. Phil, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem, it's a pleasure.
Excellent. We're here today really to talk, I guess, about the future of towns and cities and I guess the new era that is upon us in terms of what we've learned through the coronavirus. There has been some, I was going to say ridiculous, radical is the word I meant to use, planning reforms
yes.
announced to quote unquote build us out of a recession. I'm really keen to find out from you what those two things together are really going to mean for our towns and cities and for, you know, our audience watching today, those who have a role in creating our spaces going forward.
Okay, well, I mean, let's start with COVID then and the impact it's having on cities. I mean, clearly it's a very big question, and the simple answer is we don't know. What we do know is that it's accelerated some trends and jump-started others. Now, if you take my own sector of higher education, you know, in March, we went online, like most businesses. We had nearly 2.4 million students shifted to an online environment. Nearly 500,000 staff in universities across the UK did the same. At Cambridge, you know, we shut over 700 building and delivered teaching, assessment and research, and physical space became irrelevant. And that's been the experience more generally in cities. And then last month we had the A-level fiasco. And, you know, when physical space wasn't such an issue a few months ago, now all of a sudden it's a big issue again. And the university is saying we don't have the space anymore. And we seem to have forgotten that 6 months ago space was irrelevant. And I think that encapsulates some of the issues cities are facing as well. We don't need as much space as we've got. And for some reason, business as usual seems to imply that we do. So what does all that mean for cities? Well, you know, it means that there is going to be change, obviously. But we're getting conflicting stories. So you've got companies like Virgin Money who are repurposing their offices as collaboration hubs. You've got Aviva, which is trialing in September, inviting only 10% of its staff to come back to its office space. You've got Pret making redundancies. You've got Amazon and others taking on jobs, and whether that means that cities are going to evolve, suburbs are going to be more popular going forward, I think we will have to wait and see. But it does have an implication, I think, for urban policy, and it does link to what you said earlier as well about the planning changes and the planning reforms. But before we get there, I just wanted to say something else, which is that, you know, before COVID came along, our cities were facing lots of challenges anyway. Those haven't gone away. And the biggest challenge our cities face, I think, at the moment is indifference. That we're not paying enough attention to cities, to the importance of cities in tackling existential threats to humanity like climate change. And COVID's distracted us from that, but they haven't gone away and they're still going to be there. And we still need to think more about those. Now, you said radical reform in terms of planning. One of the titles that you missed out is that from me is I'm the university's representative on the Greater Cambridge Partnership on the executive board. So three local authorities, representative from business and a representative from the University of Cambridge. And for the past 4 years or so, we've been planning and implementing major changes within the city, the sub-city, the sub-region around transport, around affordable housing, around energy and around traffic congestion. And I must say that we've come across a lot of challenges. We've come across a lot of issues that we've had to address. None of them have been related to planning. The acceleration of growth in Cambridge has not been held up by planning. It's been held up by governance congestion. There are just far too many bodies and local authorities with a stake in this and trying to coordinate and implement major infrastructural investment has been around governance. It hasn't been around planning. So that's the first point. The second point, and coming back to this question of radical, how radical are they? Now, you know, if like me, you've been working in planning and researching and writing about planning for over a number of decades, you've got to ask the question, how many times have we been here before? You know, you go back to, in my case, remembering Geoffrey Howe and Nick Wrigley and Lord Faulkner and Eric Pickles, and you can almost cut and paste from earlier critiques of planning, the kind of thing that's being put on the table now. And the more important question to me is, why do we keep every 10 years or so having apparently the most radical reform of planning since the Second World War? What can we learn from the fact that we keep having to do this? And I think the answer is quite simple, really, is that there is no perfect planning system. You get the planning you deserve, and you've got the situation where you're trying to balance a number of conflicting objectives. You want a quick system, but you want a system that's comprehensive as well. And comprehensive isn't quick, it takes time. And then you want certainty for communities and for landowners and developers, but at the same time, you want flexibility so you can account for the radical changes and the things that you didn't look at originally. And you've got a situation over the past four decades or so where the system's moved within that framework, emphasising certainty, emphasising flexibility. And none of them are the perfect approach. And what you do is, what we seem to be experiencing, is this shifting of the pendulum between these different kind of philosophies of what kind of system we want. And asking that question, I think, will give you an answer where you don't have to, every 10 to 15 years, try and reinvent the wheel. So that was a long answer to your question about how these two massive changes to cities might play out going forward. And I think the problem is that the planning reforms don't map onto the kind of challenges that places like Cambridge are facing, and that the issues around COVID and the impact on cities and urban policy are far too early for us to be able to draw any conclusions from them.
So do you think it's a we're kind of asking the wrong question when we're trying to reform planning. I really loved your view that the biggest challenge is indifference, and you know, perhaps that's the question that we need to answer. We need to figure out, well, why are we indifferent to these colossal challenges that you know, not just Cambridge faces, but the entire planet faces? Yeah. And if we put those at the center of reform, or just a new way of thinking about things, will we solve the problems that we think planning has?
Yeah. I mean, again, looking at it from my experience in the Cambridge context, and I'm sure this scales up to other cities as well, the kind of challenges that cities are facing right now are around, you know, things like affordable housing, around air pollution, around an aging population. Some are facing massive problems around opioid addiction. The platform economy is creating huge amounts of disruption in the economies of cities. Some are benefiting, some are losing out. I mean, those are the kind of challenges, and we don't really seem to have how to handle any of those, COVID aside. And you know, trying to blame the planning system for the lack of housing delivery is just a very narrow perspective on what it is we need to do to start to address some of the challenges that cities face. And I'm sure we're going to come on to this later on about the book that I've just written on the Forgotten City, the impact of digital technology. But the challenges that cities face are really wicked. They're wicked problems. They're complex. They require investment of time and energy. And at the moment, I think what we're trying to do is look for simple solutions in terms of what we can do. So smart cities, digital technology, etc., are all promising us that we can have everything. You know, you can go on a website, you can click on something, it's delivered tomorrow. That doesn't translate in some of the complex problems that cities face. And we're building up an expectation that we can have these kind of easy decisions that are costless and they are quick, and we can address them as though we're consumers. And in fact, if you look at some of the experience of continental cities, where that you know they don't expect major changes in cities from policy interventions to come within 20 or even 30 years. That's the kind of time scales and investment that cities need to address some of these complex issues. So there's a mismatch here between our expectations of what we want and how we're going to address them, and the kind of complexity and investment of time that they require within our cities. And that's where I mean this indifference fits in to how are we going to solve them.
That sounds like, as well as indifferent, we've become really naive as to the solutions, that we think everything is a click of a button away, and that there are these simple solutions.
Yes, I mean, and let's be clear as well that, you know, cities are absolutely critical to how we address things like the climate emergency. You know, the majority of the energy we use, the majority of the food resources and water resources, etc., they're concentrated in cities. If you're going to address these questions and issues, you do it through cities. Cities are also the places where we come together, because we all live in close proximity. You have to get along. You have to find ways in which you move forward with agreement, and not everybody's going to buy into it, but they have the tools and the techniques because they, you know, because of their very nature. And that's how we're going to address some of these. And that's why we've got these, that, you know, a number of cities are leading the way on how do we address these existential challenges to humanity. So they're more important than ever, and we really have to, you know, give them the attention they need to be able to help us help ourselves.
For those cities, what are the cities that you look to, and what specifics are they doing that we should be learning from?
So again, there are collections of cities around the world that are working together, and this is what's important, I think, in terms of how we go forward. That a lot of the answers here aren't founding almost in nations anymore. They're found in networks of cities working together and learning from each other and looking at each other's experiences. So in the kind of work that Vienna's doing, or Melbourne's doing, or Vancouver is doing, they are connecting with each other and looking to each other and saying, ah, that works there, or this is a way of doing it here. And they're all doing it in their own ways, because they have to reflect their own circumstances and characteristics, etc. And London's making a number of advances in that area too. But, you know, London has more in common with New York and San Francisco than it does with cities in the UK now. And there is almost a supranational network of connectivity of these cities, where they are working together. When, you know, some countries like the US have pulled out the Paris climate change agreement, a lot of cities like Chicago said, we're going to do it anyway.
That's great. And you mentioned your book earlier, upcoming book, which I'd like to come back to. And it's the title anyway. I know we haven't seen a preview of it yet, but it's coming out next year, isn't it? But it sounds really interesting, and I guess hopefully controversial as well. So the title is The Forgotten City: How Big Tech, Bad Government, and General Distraction Are Threatening Humanity's Greatest Achievement. So what for you is humanity's greatest achievement, and how are those things messing it up?
Well, I mean, the humanity's greatest achievement to me are cities. It's how we've managed to come together, to face collective challenges, and do so in ways that, are resource efficient, that are democratic and open and transparent, etc. The challenge to me, and this is what the book is about really, isn't necessarily digital technology, because there are huge benefits that come from digital technology. We are better connected, we are more open and transparent, etc. The challenge is that and what is threatening, I think, the future of cities, is that we're rushing into this. We're rushing into this idea that the smart city is the answer. The smart city is how we're going to address all of these problems, and it's how we're going to address some of these problems. But the issue for me is that not all of the challenges that cities face are easily addressed by digital technology. And I talked about some of those earlier. And in fact, it's worse in a way, because you can see how digital technology is actually making these challenges worse through the impacts of Airbnb, Amazon, high streets, whatever it might be. Now, you can take a longer view, and I talk a bit about this, that cities have actually risen to the challenge of technology and grown and evolved, and we've all benefited, it be it steam, the 19th century industrial revolution, or oil in the 20th century, or concrete and skyscrapers, etc. I think this time, though, it's different, because we're handing over control, we're handing over a lot of what are essentially political questions that are very tricky and will require us to invest time and energy in coming up with solutions, to algorithms, to artificial intelligence, to machine learning, to the platform economy. And that will suit certain kinds of problems. You know, traffic optimization is something that smart cities promise. But what does that have to say about poverty? And what does it have to say about homelessness? And the problem is, if we are withdrawing from that political arena, then smart will inevitably fill that vacuum. And we might not like some of the answers that it comes up with. So I come forward with a number of suggestions in the end about shifting the emphasis of digital technology and smart from an ends to a means. And what does that imply for how we go about rethinking our relationship with smart, in terms of planning, in terms of our how we think about space and territory, and how we think about process. And I wrote all of this before the white paper came out, and a lot of it before COVID came out as well. And you have to say that, you know, we have managed as a nation and globally because in this current situation of digital technology. And again, we have to be very careful that we're not trying to uninvent it. We can't live in a kind of a Faraday cage and shut ourselves off from something that's going on. It's about using it to the ends that we decide, rather than handing over control and asking the likes of Amazon and Facebook and Google, etc., to decide what the ends are themselves.
Yeah, I think tech has been a great enabler in this period, hasn't it? But I feel like one of the greatest lessons that I've certainly learned from all this is a human lesson. Like I have understood a lot more about my colleagues and about how human beings react in a time like this. So how important for you in making sure that, you know, those cities do continue to thrive, not just survive, is the civilian, the city liver, city worker?
No, I think so. And you can imagine places like London are always going to thrive. These are the kind of cities that we're not, you know, that are not necessarily under threat in the same way as Huddersfield, for example. Because what we're experiencing here, and it comes back to what you were saying about the people element of it, is a big sort. You know, cities are being sorted at the moment. They're being sorted within, where, you know, the large parts of successful alpha cities, if you like, that are benefiting from globalization and digital technology are becoming unaffordable for those people that we need, or the cities and we need to live and to work there. And at the same time, there's a big sort going on between cities, and the gaps of you know, exclusion and poverty between some of our cities are widening as well. And, you know, the successful city, what you need to look to, what is a successful city, and successful for whom? And you can focus on inward investments and on GDP, etc. But at the end of the day, they have to be successful for a broad range of people and communities. You know, San Francisco is struggling to find teachers and nurses and people to work in essential services because they can't afford to live anywhere close by. They're having to commute 2 or 3 hours a day. And that, to me, isn't a successful city, regardless of the fact that Silicon Valley is just around the corner and you know, as basically transformed the way we live. So it's about the people as well as the cities. And what we don't want, I think, is to replicate that across our cities in the UK.
How much of a role do you see then the built environment having in creating those successful cities? A city where, you know, it can get inward investment, there can be you know all sorts of development going on. It could be an economically vibrant city, but also a city that delivers social value and creates that place for people to be able to live, work and play.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm sure you've seen them. There are a number of indices of the most livable cities, and, you know, despite the different outcomes, there are some cities that are always there in the top 10, the top 20. And there's a very strong correlation between those cities that are constantly in the different livable cities index and the amount of time and effort and resources they put into what we might broadly call city planning. I don't mean town planning here. You know, in terms of transport, in terms of services. These things aren't easy, they're not cheap, and they require investment. But if you want to have the economically successful with the socially and the environmental, that your true sustainable city, you can't just step back. You have to get involved and seek to manage the future of the city. So the built environment is going to be critical to that. but you need to look right across to the economic, the social, and the environmental. And it's the social in particular, I think, that's losing out. Going back to the government's proposals, you know, there's the economic in there, and there's the built environment, the beauty element in there. There's not so much in there about that social element, and that to me is the bit that if you like, you should be looking at to judge whether or not your city is successful and livable, not just the economic and the aesthetic or the built environment.
And I guess that should be the easiest thing to do, because we're all human beings and we should understand how, you know, our wants and needs and what perfect looks like to us. But it seems to be the most difficult for people to get their heads around.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, again, coming back to Cambridge, I mean, Cambridge is a small city with a very big university, two universities, one very big university in it. But within its 110,000 or so population, you have a life expectancy difference of 10 years between the wealthy part and the poorest part. And they're a couple of miles apart. And you know, again, on the work on the Greater Cambridge Partnership and working with stakeholders in there, these are almost no-brainers in terms of the issues. They're the most difficult ones to fix. So housing affordability is critical. Public transport is critical. These aren't easy. As I was saying right at the beginning, for a variety of reasons, even if you have the money, which the Greater Cambridge Partnership City deal has, to get right and to put in the kind of infrastructure and to do the kind of interventions that are necessary to make even a small city like Cambridge more equal and more livable.
So maybe there's a change of what's the word I'm trying to think of? You know, we need to be judged on different things. What makes a successful city? That there is equality is the target, not investment or, yeah, you know, the availability of jobs. It's the availability of jobs for all, and that, you know, that 10-year gap gets to zero.
Yeah. So places like Bristol have a thriving city index, and within the thriving city index there are a range of criteria, not just on the economic side, and they monitor that every year, and the city council then says, okay, what do we need to do to move this particular part of to make this a happier place you know, than it is, and it gives you a clear evidence of what are the issues that people are facing, and what are the priorities that places like Bristol need to focus upon to, you know, to deliver across the spectrum of a city, not just simply on economic, because, you know, Bristol economically is a successful place. It's actually one of the least happy places in the country as well. And, you know, you've got to start asking yourself, well, what is a city council there to do?
Hmm. And how do we turn the volume up on that question, I suppose, and make sure that we have the right leadership in place to, you know, not turn it back down again and not sort of push it down the line, because it's a difficult question to answer.
Yeah, I mean, so the government are going to come out with proposals shortly on and mayors in cities, and they've created a number of those, and a big supporter of the principle of that. At the same time, they also need to start thinking, and I think they will, about reorganising local government. We have a situation where, as I was saying earlier, there are that many stakeholders trying to do what they think are the right things. That's actually making it more difficult, and having a much more focused approach to how do we identify the issues, and then how do we take them forward, and not losing the kind of efficiencies you can when you're coordinating across boundaries and between different scales and different political representations, etc. I think that has got to be a big part of the answer. The other answer, part of the answer, and again, this is pushing an open door, has to be greater devolution to responsibility. So it's much clearer where that responsibility for the kind of issues we've talked about lies. At the moment, it's very easy in places like Cambridge to say that's a county council problem, or that's the combined authorities problem, etc. So that level of focused responsibility and accountability, I think, are both going to be critical if we are going to start to focus on the broader questions that our cities are facing.
It sounds like there's a little bit of a sort of bystander apathy at the moment. That's not that someone else is going to deal with that, so I don't have to.
Yeah.
And I guess that makes it, you know, there's an ideal opportunity here for the built environment to seize the opportunity to be the good guy in this situation. You know, it doesn't have the reputation of being the good guy that thinks about humans and social value. Do you think that there is a sort of turning of the tide there, and we could see the built environment really put this at the heart of what they do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so again, some of the positive things to come out of the last few months has been the emphasis on space, upon cities not just being there in terms of their normal functions, but creating space for people to walk, people to cycle, creating space within cities. And again, we're doing this in Cambridge, is, you know, temporarily closing some roads, and it's gone down really well. So the built environment actually, I think, has a very important positive role to play in the extent to which people feel as though they're part of a place. But also, it's not just somewhere where, you know, they have a house, it's somewhere where they have a home, if you like, and that level of investment, that's, you know, you can feel much more embedded in a place if you're happy there, and the changes that are happening are actually there to support your life. So I think the built environment is definitely I think part of the solution here. And again, going back to the one of the first points about business as usual, I genuinely hope that business as usual isn't going backward, that we don't lose some of the experiences and the positiveness, and what you were saying about the importance of people and colleagues, etc., when things do return to hopefully normal.
Excellent. And then just turning a little bit more to Cambridge and Cambridge specifically, and where you sit in the university. Obviously, the universities have had a bit of a challenging time through COVID. The way that they are going to operate going forward is shifting. What, for you, and given the role that they play, such a huge role that they play within Cambridge, for you, what are you seeing as the major challenges for the colleges, and how are you seeing that will play out in the future?
Yes, so colleges in particular in Cambridge are facing some serious financial challenges, as you say, and that comes from a number of sources, not only the uncertainty over how many students are going to turn up, particularly overseas students, although that seems now to be firming up a bit, but also, I mean, in the Cambridge context, colleges, you know, also derive a lot of their income from commercial activity. Students are only here half the year, and the other half of the year, they have this very large sunk cost in accommodation and catering, etc., which they use to generate income from conferences and language schools, etc. That has completely gone. And at the moment, I think the colleges are all looking for a more resilient alternative to that financial model. And Cambridge is unusual in that it's taken the kind of residential university model. Students come here, they live here in college, A number of other universities, UCL, etc., far less residential. You know, you go find accommodation in the private sector. And I think that residential model may well now be started to be questioned as well. And again, going back to the not losing the experiences and the positives out of the last few months, the extent and ease of which we went online, I think shouldn't be forgotten as well. And for some students, a blended approach with, you know, face-to-face plus online plus remotes, etc., may well be an attractive model or alternative going forward, particularly, you know, post next year and Brexit, where universities start to look much more internationally to collaborations and overseas campuses, which they inevitably will going forward. That's, you know, this idea that students are going to come to you, I think, has been questioned, if not broken. You really have to make the effort to go to the student and provide something that's attractive to the student. And that isn't just simply about coming to Cambridge. That has to be a variety of alternatives and different models as well. The other big challenge that colleges and the university face are in the city, because, you know, we face exactly the same issues that major employees in the city face. We can attract people to apply for jobs here. We can attract PhD students and postdocs, and then they'll take one look at the housing and the housing affordability issue, and they'll think again. The congestion, the you know, the schools being full, etc. So we really have to engage much more, and this is part of, again, why the university was one of the founders of the City Deal, to try and work with other businesses and local authorities to come up with ways forward to address those kind of challenges and issues as well that we're all facing. And that's a big change for Cambridge. You know, the town and gown thing's always been a strong, as it has been in Oxford as well. We can't carry on that way. And we'll see things like East-West Rail make a big difference, you know, going forward as well. But, you know, so the university really has to evolve. It really has to start thinking much more outwardly and beyond its own, you know, silo, into how do we engage with others within the city and beyond to try and help some of the you know, we cause some of these problems. The housing affordability issue is largely a product of the success of the University of Cambridge in growing and the kind of spin-off companies, etc. We have a moral responsibility to help solve the problems as well.
Yeah, I think the word collaboration was a big buzzword in a year or two ago, but it sounds like now it's, you know, it's not a buzzword, it's a necessity now, and that businesses, colleges, people are understanding that, you know, we don't get through this on our own. We have to link up with each other and look for, borrow solutions from each other and work together to get out the other side better.
Absolutely. And I think this is where, you know, the colleges are also looking for help and support, is that we are all incredibly conscious of and committed to addressing things, you know, reducing carbon. We're all in the same boat. We just, at the moment, don't know how to go about doing that. We're all looking around at each other saying, well, how do we do it? What should we do? We occupy some old buildings, some new buildings. Some have more money than others. Some have better resources, etc. What do we do? And you know, so these, again, are common challenges, and this level of cooperation and coordination is absolutely necessary. And this is why the colleges and university, I think, need support from, you know, the professional groups as well, the Savills of this world, to say to the challenges, you know, these are the challenges that we are facing. We don't have the answers, do you? And I think that level of collaboration and coordination is going to be necessary as well.
Yeah, it's about showing some vulnerability, I suppose.
Yeah, and it
seems like it sort of to take us back to where we started. You know, it doesn't require radical reform. It requires listening to each other, being honest with each other about the challenges that we all face, and then thinking about, you know, the difficult simple solutions that there are.
Yes, indeed. You know, and again, looking, and I know a number of my colleagues wouldn't be overly happy with this, looking across to Oxford. We're not the only collegiate, college-based institution that are facing some of these problems as well. And yeah, it's not that far away, but it seems a long, long way away.
and so to round us off for today's discussion, if we fast forward 10, maybe 20, maybe even 50 years into the future, you've already written a lot of very interesting books, new one coming out next year. If you're still writing in 50 years and you look back at this unique period in time, what do you think you would be writing about, or you would be talking to students at the university about?
Well, you know, I think to look forward, you need to look backwards. And again, coming back to this point about, you know, why are we still going through this situation? And what can we learn from our experience of doing this repeatedly over and over again? And one of the big takeaways, and this is why I emphasize this to students as well, is that you know, there is so much local ownership and discretion involved in planning in the built environments, regardless of some of these changes, that you know, local authorities and other stakeholders are committed to planning cities and doing it successfully and doing it in the right ways. If you look back to some of the early changes, the early 1980s, which sought to, you know, completely deregulate planning, not dissimilar ways to now, you had a completely different approach to what we might term beauty, because the government has called it that. And one of the changes in 1980 was to say the appearance of a building is up to the market to decide. If it's attractive, people will pay more. And, you know, that's how we decide what a beautiful building or built environment is going to be. Local authorities, quite right, and developers, quite rightly said, you know, that doesn't work for us. We need to still have some kind of input. We're not going to simply let the market decide. You fast forward it to some of the proposals that are coming out now, and I think you will find the same again, that local authorities, landowners and developers and agents and others will say, okay, we see what you're trying to do here, but actually we're going to do it this way instead. And I think there's still enough discretion within the system to allow those involved to say, we see what you're trying to do, but here that doesn't make sense to us, we're going to do it this way. And, you know, that's one of the big lessons for me over the past 40 years in terms of changes to city planning. And I strongly suspect that that will be, if I was looking back in 50 years time, would be part of that pattern as well. But a lot of the sharp edges would have been knocked off.
Well, let's hope that we don't continue to sort of repeat the same problems and bang our heads against a brick wall. Phil, thanks so much for joining us today. That was a great discussion.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the EG Property Podcast. And do not forget, if you want to keep up with all the latest news, views, analysis and research that the EG Group has to provide, sign up to all of our property podcasts and do subscribe to Radius Data Exchange to make sure you have unlimited access to all of our content and our comprehensive commercial real estate data.